Chapter 9. Tellings of the Wheel. Rand's heart pounded as he ran, and he stared in dismay at the barren hills surrounding him. This was not just a place where spring was late in coming. Spring had never come here, and never would come. Nothing grew in the cold soil that crunched under his boots, not so much as a bit of lichen. He scrambled past boulders twice as tall as he was. Dust coated the stone, as if never a drop of rain had touched it. The sun was a swollen, blood-red ball, more fiery than on the hottest day of summer, and bright enough to sear his eyes. But it stood dark against a leaden cauldron of a sky where clouds of sharp black and silver roiled and boiled on every horizon. For all the swirling clouds, though, no breath of breeze stirred across the land, and despite the sullen sun, the air burned cold like the depths of winter. Rand looked over his shoulder often as he ran, but he could not see his pursuers. Only desolate hills and jagged black mountains, many topped by tall plumes of dark smoke rising to join the milling clouds. If he could not see his hunters, though, he could hear them, howling behind him, guttural voices shouting with the glee of the chase, howling with the joy of blood to come. Trollocs, coming closer, and his strength was almost gone. With desperate haste, he scrambled to the top of a knife-edged ridge, then dropped to his knees with a groan. Below him, a sheer rock wall fell away, a 1,000-foot cliff plummeting into a vast canyon. Steamy mists covered the canyon floor, their thick gray surface rolling in grim waves, rolling and breaking against the cliff beneath him, but more slowly than any ocean wave had ever moved. Patches of fog glowed red for an instant, as if great fires had suddenly flared beneath, then died. Thunder rumbled in the depths of the valley, and lightning crackled through the gray, sometimes striking up at the sky. It was not the valley itself that sapped his strength and filled the empty spaces left with helplessness. From the center of the furious vapors, a mountain thrust upward. A mountain taller than any he had ever seen in the mountains of mist. A mountain as black as the loss of all hope. That bleak stone spire, a dagger stabbing at the heavens, was the source of his desolation. He had never seen it before, but he knew it. The memory of it flashed away like quicksilver when he tried to touch it, but the memory was there. He knew it was there. Unseen fingers touched him, pulled at his arms and legs, trying to draw him to the mountain. His body twitched, ready to obey. His arms and legs stiffened, as if he thought he could dig his fingers and toes into the stone. Ghostly strings entwined around his heart, pulling him, calling him to the spire mountain. Tears ran down his face, and he sagged to the ground. He felt his will draining away like water out of a holed bucket. Just a little longer, and he would go where he was called. He would obey, do as he was told. Abruptly, he discovered another emotion. Anger. Push him, pull him. He was not a sheep to be prodded into a pen. The anger squeezed itself into one hard knot, and he clung to it as he would have clung to a raft in a flood. Serve me, a voice whispered in the stillness of his mind. A familiar voice. If he listened hard enough, he was sure he would know it. Serve me. He shook his head to try to get it out of his head. Serve me. He shook his fist at the black mountain. The light consume you, Shaitan. Abruptly, the smell of death lay thick around him. A figure loomed over him in a cloak the color of dried blood, a figure with a face. He did not want to see the face that looked down at him. He did not want to think of that face. It hurt to think of it, turned his mind to embers. A hand reached toward him. Not caring if he fell over the edge, he threw himself away. He had to get away, far away. He fell, flailing at the air, wanting to scream, finding no breath for screaming, no breath at all. Abruptly, he was no longer in the barren land, no longer falling. Winter brown grass flattened under his boots. It seemed like flowers. He almost laughed to see scattered trees and bushes, leafless as they were, dotting the gently rolling plain that now surrounded him. In the distance reared a single mountain, its peak broken and split, but this mountain brought no fear or despair. It was just a mountain, though oddly out of place there, with no other in sight. A broad river flowed by the mountain, and on an island in the middle of that river was a city such as might live in a gleeman's tale, a city surrounded by high walls gleaming white and silver beneath the warm sun. With mingled relief and joy, he started for the walls, for the safety and serenity he somehow knew he would find behind them. As he came closer, he made out soaring towers, many joined by wondrous walkways that spanned the open air. High bridges arced from both banks of the river to the island city. Even at a distance, he could see lacy stonework on those spans, seemingly too delicate to withstand the swift waters that rushed beneath them. Beyond those bridges lay safety, sanctuary. Of a sudden, a chill ran along his bones. An icy clamminess settled on his skin, and the air around him turned fetid and dank. Without looking back, he ran from the pursuer whose freezing fingers brushed his back and tugged at his cloak. Ran from the light-eating figure with the face that... He could not remember the face, except as terror. He did not want to remember the face. He ran, and the ground passed beneath his feet, rolling hills and flat plain. And he wanted to howl like a dog gone mad. The city was receding before him. The harder he ran, the further away drifted the white shining walls and haven. They grew smaller and smaller until only a pale speck remained on the horizon. The cold hand of his pursuer clutched at his collar. If those fingers touched him, he knew he would go mad, or worse, much worse. Even as that surety came to him, he tripped and fell. "No!" he screamed, and grunted as paving stones smacked the breath out of him. Wonderingly, he got to his feet. He stood on the approaches to one of the marvelous bridges he had seen rearing over the river. Smiling people walked by on either side of him, people dressed in so many colors they made him think of a field of wildflowers. Some of them spoke to him, but he could not understand, though the words sounded as if he should. But the faces were friendly, and the people gestured him onward, over the bridge with its intricate stonework, onward toward the shining, silver-streaked walls and the towers beyond, toward the safety he knew waited there. He joined the throng streaming across the bridge and into the city through massive gates set in tall, pristine walls. Within was a wonderland where the meanest structure seemed a palace. It was as though the builders had been told to take stone and brick and tile and create beauty to take the breath of mortal men. There was no building, no monument that did not make him stare with goggling eyes. Music drifted down the streets, 100 different songs, but all blending with the clamor of the crowds to make one grand, joyous harmony. The scents of sweet perfumes and sharp spices, of wondrous foods and myriad flowers all floated in the air, as if every good smell in the world were gathered there. The street by which he entered the city, broad and paved with smooth gray stone, stretched straight before him toward the center of the city. At its end loomed a tower larger and taller than any other in the city, a tower as white as fresh-fallen snow. That tower was where safety lay, and the knowledge he sought. But the city was such as he had never dreamed of seeing. Surely it would not matter if he delayed just a short time in going to the tower. He turned aside onto a narrower street where jugglers strolled among hawkers of strange fruits. Ahead of him down the street was a snow-white tower, the same tower. In just a little while, he thought, and rounded another corner. At the far end of this street, too, lay the white tower. Stubbornly, he turned another corner, and another, and each time, the alabaster tower met his eyes. He spun to run away from it, and skidded to a halt. Before him, the white tower. He was afraid to look over his shoulder, afraid it would be there, too. The faces around him were still friendly, but shattered hope filled them now. Hope he had broken. Still the people gestured him forward, pleading gestures. Toward the tower. Their eyes shone with desperate need, and only he could fulfill it. Only he could save them. Very well, he thought. The tower was, after all, where he wanted to go. Even as he took his first step forward, disappointment faded from those about him, and smiles wreathed every face. They moved with him, and small children strewed his path with flower petals. He looked over his shoulder in confusion, wondering who the flowers were meant for, but behind him were only more smiling people, gesturing him on. They must be for me, he thought, and wondered why that suddenly did not seem strange at all. but wonderment lasted only a moment before melting away. All was as it should be. First one, then another of the people began to sing until every voice was lifted into a glorious anthem. He still could not understand the words, but a dozen interweaving harmonies shouted joy and salvation. Musicians capered through the onflowing crowd, adding flutes and harps and drums in a dozen sizes to the hymn, and all the songs he had heard before blended in without seam. Girls danced around him, laying garlands of sweet-smelling blossoms across his shoulders, twining them about his neck. They smiled at him, their delight growing with every step he took. He could not help but smile back. His feet itched to join in their dance, and even as he thought of it, he was dancing, his steps fitting in as if he had known it all from birth. He threw back his head and laughed. His feet were lighter than they had ever been, dancing with... he could not remember the name, but it did not seem important. "It is your destiny," a voice whispered in his head, and the whisper was a thread in the paean. Carrying him like a twig on the crest of a wave, the crowd flowed into a huge square in the middle of the city, and for the first time he saw that the White Tower rose from a great palace of pale marble, sculpted rather than built, curving walls and swelling domes and delicate spires fingering the sky. The whole of it made him gasp in awe. Broad stairs of pristine stone led up from the square, and at the foot of those stairs the people halted, but their song rose ever higher. The swelling voices buoyed his feet. "Your destiny," the voice whispered, insistent now, eager. He no longer danced, but neither did he stop. He mounted the stairs without hesitation. This was where he belonged. Scrollwork covered the massive doors at the top of the stairs, carvings so intricate and delicate that he could not imagine a knife blade fine enough to fit. The portals swung open, and he went in. They closed behind him with an echoing crash like thunder.
"We have been waiting for you," the Murdral hissed.
Rand sat bolt upright, gasping for breath and shivering, staring. Tam was still asleep on the bed. Slowly his breathing slowed. Half-consumed logs blazed in the fireplace with a good bed of coals built up around the fire irons. Someone had been there to tend to it while he slept. A blanket lay at his feet, where it had fallen when he woke. The makeshift litter was gone, too, and his and Tam's cloaks had been hung by the door. He wiped cold sweat from his face with a hand that was none too steady, and wondered if naming the Dark One in a dream brought his attention the same way that naming him aloud did. Twilight darkened the window. The moon was well up, round and fat, and evening stars sparkled above the mountains of mist. He had slept the day away. He rubbed a sore spot on his side. Apparently, he had slept with the sword hilt jabbing him in the ribs. Between that and an empty stomach and the night before, it was no wonder he had had nightmares. His belly rumbled, and he got up stiffly and made his way to the table where Mistress Alvear had left the tray. He twitched aside the white napkin. Despite the time he had slept, the beef broth was still warm, and so was the crusty bread. Mistress Alvear's hand was plain. The tray had been replaced. Once she decided you needed a hot meal, she did not give up till it was inside you. He gulped down some broth, and it was all he could do to put some meat and cheese between two pieces of bread before stuffing it in his mouth. Taking big bites, he went back to the bed. Mistress Alvear had apparently seen to Tam as well. Tam had been undressed, his clothes now clean and neatly folded on the bedside table, and a blanket was drawn up under his chin. When Rand touched his father's forehead, Tam opened his eyes.
"There you are, boy. Marin said you were here, but I couldn't even sit up to see. She said you were too tired for her to wake, just so I could look at you. Even Bran can't get around her when she has her mind set."
Tam's voice was weak, but his gaze was clear and steady.
The Aes Sedai was right, Rand thought. With rest, he would be as good as ever.
"Can I get you something to eat? Mistress Alvear left a tray."
"She fed me already, if you can call it that.
Wouldn't let me have anything but broth. How can a man avoid bad dreams with nothing but broth in his..."
Tam fumbled a hand from under the cover and touched the sword at Rand's waist.
"Then it wasn't a dream. When Morin told me I was sick, I thought I had been..." but you're all right. That is all that matters. What of the farm?
Rand took a deep breath.
The Trollocs killed the sheep. I think they took the cow, too. And the house needs a good cleaning.
He managed a weak smile.
We were luckier than some. They burned half the village.
He told Tam everything that had happened, or at least most of it. Tam listened closely and asked sharp questions, so he found himself having to tell about returning to the farmhouse from the woods, and that brought in the Trolloc he had killed. He had to tell how Nynaeve had said Tam was dying to explain why the Aes Sedai had tended him instead of the wisdom. Tam's eyes widened at that, an Aes Sedai in Emmons Field. But Rand could see no need to go over every step of the journey from the farm, or his fears, or the Myrdral on the road. Certainly not his nightmares as he slept by the bed. Especially he saw no reason to mention Tam's ramblings under the fever. Not yet. Moraine's story, though, there was no avoiding that.
Now that's a tale to make a gleeman proud, Tam muttered when he was done. What would Trollocs want with you boys? Or the Dark One light help us?
You think she was lying?
Master Alvir said she was telling the truth about only two farms being attacked. And about Master Luhan's house and Master Cawthon's.
For a moment, Tam lay silent before saying,
Tell me what she said. Her exact words, mind. Just as she said them.
Rand struggled. Whoever remembered the exact words they heard? He chewed at his lip and scratched his head, and bit by bit, he brought it out as nearly as he could remember.
I can't think of anything else, he finished. Some of it I'm not too sure she didn't say a little differently, but it's close anyway.
It's good enough. It has to be, doesn't it? You see, lad, Aes Sedai are tricksome. They don't lie, not right out, but the truth an Aes Sedai tells you is not always the truth you think it is. You take care around her.
I've heard the stories, Rand retorted. I'm not a child.
So you're not. So you're not, Tam sighed heavily, then shrugged in annoyance. I should be going along with you just the same. The world outside the Two Rivers is nothing like Emmons Field.
That was an opening to ask about Tam going outside and all the rest of it, but Rand did not take it. His mouth fell open instead.
Just like that? I thought you would try to talk me out of it. I thought you'd have 100 reasons I should not go.
He realized he had been hoping Tam would have 100 reasons, and good ones.
Maybe not 100, Tam said with a snort, but a few did come to mind. Only they don't count for much. If Trollocs are after you, you will be safer in Tar Valon than you could ever be here. Just remember to be wary. I said I do things for their own reasons, and those are not always the reasons you think.
The Gleeman said something like that, Rand said slowly.
Then he knows what he's talking about. You listen sharp, think deep, and guard your tongue. That's good advice for any dealings beyond the Two Rivers, but most especially with Aes Sedai. And with warders. Tell Lan something, and you've as good as told Moraine. If he's a warder, then he's bonded to her as sure as the sun rose this morning. And he won't keep many secrets from her, if any.
Rand knew little about the bonding between Aes Sedai and warders, though it played a big part in every story about warders he had ever heard. It was something to do with the power, a gift to the warder, or maybe some sort of exchange. The warders got all sorts of benefits, according to the stories. They healed more quickly than other men, and could go longer without food or water or sleep. Supposedly, they could sense Trollocs if they were close enough, and other creatures of the Dark One, too, which explained how Lan and Moraine had tried to warn the village before the attack. As to what the Aes Sedai got out of it, the stories were silent. But he was not about to believe they did not get something.
I'll be careful, Rand said. I just wish I knew why. It doesn't make any sense. Why me? Why us?
I wish I knew too, boy. Blood and ashes, I wish I knew.
Tam sighed heavily.
Well, no use trying to put a broken egg back in the shell, I suppose. How soon do you have to go?
I'll be back on my feet in a day or two, and we can see about starting a new flock. Oren Daughtry has some good stock he might be willing to part with the pastures all gone, and so does John Thane.
Moraine, the Aes Sedai said you had to stay in bed. She said weeks.
Tam opened his mouth, but Rand went on.
And she talked to Mistress Alvere.
Oh, well, maybe I can talk Marin around.
Tam did not sound hopeful of it, though. He gave Rand a sharp look.
The way you avoided answering means you have to leave soon. Tomorrow? Or tonight?
Tonight,
Rand said quietly, and Tam nodded sadly.
Yes. Well, if it must be done, best not to delay. But we will see about this week's business.
He plucked at his blankets with more irritation than strength.
Perhaps I'll follow in a few days anyway. Catch you up on the road. We'll see if Marn can keep me in bed when I want to get up.
There was a tap at the door, and Lan stuck his head into the room.
Say your goodbyes quickly, sheepherder, and come. There may be trouble.
Trouble?
Rand said, and the warder growled at him impatiently.
Just hurry.
Hastily, Rand snatched up his cloak. He started to undo the sword belt, but Tam spoke up.
Keep it. You will probably have more need of it than I, though the light willing, neither of us will. Take care, lad. You hear?
Ignoring Lan's continued growls, Rand bent to grab Tam in a hug.
I will come back. I promise you that.
Of course you will,
Tam laughed. He returned the hug weakly and ended by patting Rand on the back.
I know that. And I'll have twice as many sheep for you to tend when you return. Now go, before that fellow does himself an injury.
Rand tried to hang back, tried to find the words for the question he did not want to ask, but Lan entered the room to catch him by the arm and pull him into the hall. The warder had donned a dull gray-green tunic of overlapping metal scales. His voice rasped with irritation.
We have to hurry. Don't you understand the word trouble?
Outside the room, Matt waited, cloaked and coated, and carrying his bow. A quiver hung at his waist. He was rocking anxiously on his heels, and he kept glancing off toward the stairs with what seemed to be equal parts impatience and fear.
This isn't much like the stories, Rand, is it?
He said hoarsely.
What kind of trouble?
Rand demanded, but the warder ran ahead of him instead of answering, taking the steps down two at a time. Matt dashed after him with quick gestures for Rand to follow. Shrugging into his cloak, he caught up to them downstairs. Only a feeble light filled the common room. Half the candles had burned out, and most of the rest were guttering. It was empty except for the three of them. Matt stood next to one of the front windows, peeping out as if trying not to be seen. Lan held the door open a crack and peered into the inn yard. Wondering what they could be watching, Rand went to join him. The warder muttered at him to take a care, but he did open the door a trifle wider to make room for Rand to look too. At first, he was not sure exactly what he was seeing. A crowd of village men, some 3 dozen or so, clustered near the burned-out husk of the peddler's wagon, night pushed back by the torches some of them carried. Moraine faced them, her back to the inn, leaning with seeming casualness on her walking staff. Harry Coplin stood in the front of the group with his brother Darl and Billy Conger. Sen Bowie was there as well, looking uncomfortable. Rand was startled to see Harry shake his fist at Moraine.
Leave Emmons Field, the sour-faced farmer shouted.
A few voices in the crowd echoed him, but hesitantly, and no one pushed forward. They might be willing to confront an Aes Sedai from within a crowd, but none of them wanted to be singled out. Not by an Aes Sedai who had every reason to take offense.
You brought those monsters, Darl roared.
He waved a torch over his head, and there were shouts of,
You brought them, and it's your fault,
led by his cousin Billy. Harry elbowed Sen Bowie, and the old thatcher pursed his lips and gave him a sidelong glare.
Those things, those trollocs, didn't appear until after you came, Sen muttered, barely loud enough to be heard.
He swung his head from side to side dourly as if wishing he were somewhere else, and looking for a way to get there.
You're an Aes Sedai. We want none of your sort in the Two Rivers. Aes Sedai bring trouble on their backs. If you stay, you will only bring more.
His speech brought no response from the gathered villagers, and Hari scowled in frustration. Abruptly, he snatched Darl's torch and shook it in her direction.
"Get out!" he shouted. "Or we'll burn you out!"
Dead silence fell, except for the shuffling of a few feet as men drew back. Two Rivers folk could fight back if they were attacked, but violence was far from common, and threatening people was foreign to them, beyond the occasional shaking of a fist. Senbui, Billy Conger, and the Coplins were left out front alone. Billy looked as if he wanted to back away, too. Hari gave an uneasy start at the lack of support, but he recovered quickly.
"Get out!"
he shouted again, echoed by Darl, and more weakly by Billy. Hari glared at the others. Most of the crowd failed to meet his eye. Suddenly, Bran Alvir and Harald Luhan moved out of the shadows, stopping apart from both the Aes Sedai and the crowd. In one hand, the mayor casually carried the big wooden maul he used to drive spigots into casks.
"Did someone suggest burning my inn?"
he asked softly. The two Coplins took a step back and Senbui edged away from them. Billy Conger dived into the crowd.
"Not that," Darl said quickly. "We never said that, Bran. Mayor."
Bran nodded.
"Then perhaps I heard you threatening to harm guests in my inn?"
"She's an Aes Sedai,"
Hari began angrily, but his words cut off as Harald Luhan moved. The blacksmith simply stretched, thrusting thick arms over his head, tightening massive fists until his knuckles cracked, but Hari looked at the burly man as if one of those fists had been shaken under his nose. Harald folded his arms across his chest.
"Your pardon, Hari. I did not mean to cut you off. You were saying..."
But Hari, shoulders hunched as though he were trying to draw into himself and disappear, seemed to have nothing more to say.
"I'm surprised at you people," Bran rumbled.
"Petal Kar, your boy's leg was broken last night, but I saw him walking on it today, because of her. Ewad Kandin, you were lying on your belly with a gash down your back like a fish for cleaning, till she laid hands on you. Now it looks as if it happened a month ago. And unless I misdoubt, there'll be barely a scar. And you, Sen,"
the Thatcher started to fade back into the crowd, but stopped, held uncomfortably by Bran's gaze.
"I'd be shocked to see any man on the village council here, Sen, but you most of all. Your arm would still be hanging useless at your side, a mass of burns and bruises, if not for her. If you have no gratitude, have you no shame?"
Sen half lifted his right hand, then looked away from it angrily.
"I cannot deny what she did," he muttered,
and he did sound ashamed.
"She helped me and others,"
he went on in a pleading tone.
"But she's an Aes Sedai, Bran. If those Trollocs didn't come because of her, why did they come? We want no part of Aes Sedai in the Two Rivers. Let them keep their troubles away from us."
A few men, safely back in the crowd, shouted then.
"We want no Aes Sedai troubles. Send her away. Drive her out. Why did they come if not because of her?"
A scowl grew on Bran's face, but before he could speak, Moiraine suddenly whirled her vine-carved staff above her head, spinning it with both hands. Bran's gasp echoed that of the villagers, for a hissing white flame flared from each end of the staff, standing straight out like spear points despite the rod's whirling. Even Bran and Harl edged away from her. She snapped her arms down straight out before her, the staff parallel to the ground, but the pale fire still jetted out, brighter than the torches. Men shied away, held up hands to shield their eyes from the pain of that brilliance.
"Is this what Aemon's blood has come to?"
The Aes Sedai's voice was not loud, but it overwhelmed every other sound.
"Little people squabbling for the right to hide like rabbits? You have forgotten who you were, forgotten what you were. But I had hoped some small part was left, some memory in blood and bone, some shred to steel you for the long night coming."
No one spoke. The two Coplins looked as if they had never wanted to open their mouths again.
Bran said, "Forgotten who we were. We are who we always have been. Honest farmers and shepherds and craftsmen. Two Rivers folk."
"To the south," Moiraine said, "lies the river you call the White River. But far to the east of here, men call it still by its rightful name, Mon Etherendrel. In the old tongue, Waters of the Mountain Home. sparkling waters that once coursed through a land of bravery and beauty. 2,000 years ago, Manethar Andrel flowed by the walls of a mountain city, so lovely to behold that Ogier stonemasons came to stare in wonder. Farms and villages covered this region, and that you call the Forest of Shadows as well, and beyond. But all of those folk thought of themselves as the people of the mountain home, the people of Manetharin. Their king was Aemon Alcar Althoran, Aemon, son of Kar, son of Thoran, and Eldraine, I Elan, I Carlan, was his queen. Aemon, a man so fearless that the greatest compliment for courage any could give, even among his enemies, was to say a man had Aemon's heart. Eldraine, so beautiful that it was said the flowers bloomed to make her smile. Bravery and beauty and wisdom, and a love that death could not sunder. Weep, if you have a heart, for the loss of them, for the loss of even their memory. Weep for the loss of their blood.
She fell silent then, but no one spoke. Rand was as bound as the others in the spell she had created. When she spoke again, he drank it in, and so did the rest.
For nearly 2 centuries, the Trolloc Wars had ravaged the length and breadth of the world, and wherever battles raged, the Red Eagle banner of Manetharin was in the forefront. The men of Manetharin were a thorn to the Dark One's foot and a bramble to his hand. Sing of Manetharin that would never bend knee to the shadow. Sing of Manetharin, the sword that could not be broken. They were far away, the men of Manetharin, on the field of Bekkar, called the Field of Blood, when news came that a Trolloc army was moving against their home. Too far to do else but wait to hear of their land's death, for the forces of the Dark One meant to make an end of them. Kill the mighty oak by hacking away its roots. Too far to do else but mourn. But they were the men of the mountain home. Without hesitation, without thought for the distance they must travel, they marched from the very field of victory, still covered in dust and sweat and blood. Day and night they marched, for they had seen the horror a Trolloc army left behind it, and no man of them could sleep while such a danger threatened Manetharin. They moved as if their feet had wings, marching further and faster than friends hoped or enemies feared they could. At any other day, that march alone would have inspired songs. When the Dark One's armies swooped down upon the lands of Manetharin, the men of the mountain home stood before it with their backs to the Tarandrel.
Some villager raised a small cheer then, but Moraine kept on as if she had not heard.
The host that faced the men of Manetharin was enough to daunt the bravest heart. Ravens blackened the sky. Trollocs blackened the land. Trollocs and their human allies. Trollocs and dark friends in tens of thousands, and dreadlords to command. At night their cookfires outnumbered the stars, and dawn revealed the banner of Baal-Zaman at their head. Baal-Zaman, heart of the dark. An ancient name for the father of lies. The Dark One could not have been free of his prison at Sheol-Gul, for if he had been, not all the forces of humankind together could have stood against him. But there was power there. Dreadlords, and some evil that made that light-destroying banner seem no more than right, and sent a chill into the souls of men who faced it. Yet they knew what they must do. Their homeland lay just across the river. They must keep that host and the power with it from the mountain home. Aemon had sent out messengers. Aid was promised if they could hold for but 3 days at the Tarandrel. Hold for 3 days against odds that should have overwhelmed them in the first hour. Yet somehow, through bloody assault and desperate defense, they held through an hour, and the second hour, and the third. For 3 days they fought, and though the land became a butcher's yard, no crossing of the Tarandrel did they yield. By the third night, no help had come, and no messengers, and they fought on alone. For 6 days, for 9, and on the 10th day, Aemon knew the bitter taste of betrayal. No help was coming, and they could hold the river crossings no more.
Where did they go?
Hari demanded. Torch fires flickered in the chill night breeze, but no one made a move to draw a cloak tighter.
Aemon crossed the Tarandrel, Moraine told them. destroying the bridges behind him. And he sent word throughout his land for the people to flee, for he knew the powers with the Trolloc horde would find a way to bring it across the river. Even as the word went out, the Trolloc crossing began, and the soldiers of Mon Etheren took up the fight again, to buy with their lives what hours they could for their people to escape. From the city of Mon Etheren, Eldraine organized the flight of her people into the deepest forests and the fastness of the mountains. But some did not flee. First in a trickle, then in a river, then a flood, men went not to safety, but to join the army fighting for their land. Shepherds with bows and farmers with pitchforks, and woodsmen with axes. Women went too, shouldering what weapons they could find and marching side by side with their men. No one made that journey who did not know they would never return. But it was their land. It had been their father's, and it would be their children's. And they went to pay the price of it. Not a step of ground was given up until it was soaked in blood. But at the last, the army of Mon Etheren was driven back. Back to here. To this place you now call Emmons Field. And here the Trolloc hordes surrounded them. Her voice held the sound of cold tears. Trolloc dead and the corpses of human renegades piled up in mounds, but always more scrambled over those charnel heaps in waves of death that had no end. There could be but one finish. No man or woman who had stood beneath the banner of the Red Eagle at that day's dawning still lived when night fell. The sword that could not be broken was shattered. In the mountains of mist, alone in the emptied city of Mon Etheren, Eldraine felt Aemon die, and her heart died with him. And where her heart had been was left only a thirst for vengeance. Vengeance for her love. Vengeance for her people and her land. Driven by grief, she reached out to the true source and hurled the one power at the Trolloc army. And there the Dreadlords died wherever they stood, whether in their secret councils or exhorting their soldiers. In the passing of a breath, the Dreadlords and the generals of the Dark One's host burst into flame. Fire consumed their bodies, and terror consumed their just victorious army. Now they ran like beasts before a wildfire in the forest, with no thought for anything but escape. North and south they fled. Thousands drowned attempting to cross the Tarandrel without the aid of the Dreadlords. And at the Mon Etheren, they tore down the bridges in their fright at what might be following them. Where they found people, they slew and burned. But to flee was the need that gripped them. Until at last, no one of them remained in the lands of Mon Etheren. They were dispersed like dust before the whirlwind. The final vengeance came more slowly, but it came. When they were hunted down by other peoples, by other armies in other lands, none was left alive of those who did murder at Aemon's Field. But the price was high for Mon Etheren. Eldraine had drawn to herself more of the one power than any human could ever hope to wield unaided. As the enemy generals died, so did she die. And the fires that consumed her consumed the empty city of Mon Etheren, even the stones of it, down to the living rock of the mountains. Yet the people had been saved. Nothing was left of their farms, their villages, or their great city. Some would say there was nothing left for them, nothing but to flee to other lands, where they could begin anew. They did not say so. They had paid such a price in blood and hope for their land as had never been paid before, and now they were bound to that soil by ties stronger than steel. Other wars would rack them in years to come, until at last their corner of the world was forgotten. And at last, they had forgotten wars and the ways of war. Never again did Mon Etheren rise. Its soaring spires and splashing fountains became as a dream that slowly faded from the minds of its people. But they and their children's children, held the land that was theirs. They held it when the long centuries had washed the why of it from their memories. They held it until today. There is you. Weep for Mon Etheren. Weep for what is lost forever.
The fires and Moraine's staff winked out, and she lowered it to her side as if it weighed 100 pounds. For a long moment, the moan of the wind was the only sound. Then Pate Alkar shouldered past the Coplins.
"I don't know about your story," the long-jawed farmer said. "I'm no thorn to the Dark One's foot, nor ever likely to be, neither. But my will is walking because of you, and for that I'm ashamed to be here. I don't know if you can forgive me, but whether you will or no, I'll be going. And for me, you can stay in Emmons Field as long as you like."
With a quick duck of his head, almost a bow, he pushed back through the crowd. Others began to mutter then, offering shamefaced penitence before they, too, slipped away one by one. The Coplins, sour-mouthed and scowling once more, looked at the faces around them and vanished into the night without a word. Billy Conger had disappeared even before his cousins. Land pulled Rand back and shut the door.
"Let's go, boy."
The warder started for the back of the inn.
"Come along, both of you, quickly."
Rand hesitated, exchanging a wondering glance with Matt. While Moraine had been telling the story, Master Alvir's Durans could not have dragged him away, but now something else held his feet. This was the real beginning, leaving the inn and following the warder into the night. He shook himself and tried to firm his resolve. He had no choice but to go, but he would come back to Emmons Field, however far or long this journey was.
"What are you waiting for?"
Lan asked from the door that led out of the back of the common room. With a start, Matt hurried to him. Trying to convince himself that he was beginning a grand adventure, Rand followed them through the darkened kitchen and out into the stable yard.